Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. President Obama's three-day summit with 50 African leaders this week was the largest gathering of its kind with a sitting U.S. leader. Most of the national coverage focused on how this will affect President Obama's legacy, the announcement from U.S. businesses to invest $34 billion in projects across Africa, and the fashion, the menus, and the entertainment. But Human Rights Watch says at least a dozen of the 50 heads of state who attended the event lead repressive governments that have imprisoned journalists, human rights defenders, and anti-corruption campaigners. The Guardian's Chris McGreal reports that security and trade trumped human rights issues. Chris McGreal is a senior writer for The Guardian U.S. He's a former Washington correspondent and was previously based in Johannesburg and Jerusalem. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the show.
Yes, hello.
And on Thursday, President Obama told corporations to be economic patriots. He said they should stop using tax loopholes to move their headquarters overseas to lower their tax bills. The technique is called corporate inversion, and it allows corporations to take over a foreign firm, reincorporate in that country, and then avoid U.S. taxes on foreign earned profits. So far this year, 9 companies have undergone inversion, and we'll talk about those later in the show. After a major public pressure campaign, Walgreens just announced that it will buy the British retailer Alliance Boots for $15 billion, but it will not relocate its headquarters overseas. And joining us to talk about coverage of that is Andrew Ross. He writes the Bottom Line business column for the San Francisco Chronicle, and his latest piece is about Walgreens. Hi, Andrew. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning, Rose.
Good morning. And we're joined by Mike Konzel. He's a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute and a contributor to The Nation magazine. He just launched a monthly economics column for The Nation called The Score. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Nice to have you. So as we always do on Friday, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So, Mike, why don't we start off with you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
I was a big fan of the online magazine The Intercept, which has been very focused on national security issues. A reporter there named Jeremy Scahill and Ryan Dvork. We had this great piece about the government watch list and how many people are on it and how many people are on it for really no good reason, and basically how there's just all these incentives to really scale it up in a way that's, you know, really kind of defies normal accountability, and people don't know they're on it, and, you know, and in turn kind of accelerates this way. And I thought, you know, they got these documents from the government. I thought it was just a great way of kind of explaining it to people. There's a lot of really good charts in it. And that was just really good explanatory journalism that I hopefully will make a difference.
Can you give us the numbers? I'm trying to look for that piece right now, but they're kind of, I mean, they're shocking. When you look at the number of people who were on the list before 9/11 and the number who are on now.
Yeah, and what's most interesting is that it really accelerated in 2009 and 2010. Part of it was there was the underwear bomber, I think, that happened around Christmas going into 2010. And that really kind of made, you know, agencies very nervous that, you know, there would be another major attack on their watch. And so they had this huge incentive to really scale up the program, and there's no counterbalancing incentive to scale it back down once they realize they probably went too far. And so you have about 45%, maybe 40% of the people who are on the terrorism watch list have no recognized terrorist group affiliation. That's about a quarter million people. That's a lot of people, and you know, that's resources, you know, tracking these people, storing them, that aren't going to keeping an eye on legitimate terrorist groups or people who may really wish us harm.
Mm. All right, so we'll put that link, that story, on our website right after the show. Barack Obama's secret terrorist tracking system by the numbers: 680,000 people are on the U.S. government's terrorist screening database, and that's by Jeremy Scahill and Ryan Devereaux of The Intercept. Thank you for that one. And Andrew, what about you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
I saw a lot of things, and I sort of clipped out a lot of things, but because the WHO, I think it was today, declared a health emergency in West Africa on the Ebola virus, I chose something from my own paper, The Chronicle, and a story that Stephanie Lee did a couple of days ago, headlined "Why Cure for Ebola is a Low Priority." And it's a low priority because, as one of her interview subjects said, there isn't the business model to find, you know, a cure or a drug for it. The full quote is, "There's no business model for this, unfortunately. We're talking about a proportionally that a disease that proportionally affects the poorest segment of the population in developing countries, as a result, without incentives, we're very unlikely to see a vaccine in the near future, which I think obviously said a lot. And this wasn't said dismissively. This was said by a guy from UCSF who's sort of very much into, you know, research and looking for cures. But I mean, I think he spoke to a certain reality, which I think we're sort of more broadly aware of. But it seems to me that that sort of explanation maybe won't do, like it didn't really do with AIDS. I mean, it took a long time for the world to get to grips and governments to get to grips with AIDS. And maybe, depending on where this Ebola virus actually goes, maybe it's time to take this a whole lot more seriously in terms of having to sort of get together and not just rely on drug companies, you know, to come up with something.
Well, because this is getting international headlines, it's pretty much leading the news right now. Mm-hmm. Where is this angle? Because this is such an important angle. I have not heard in most stories that no cure or vaccine exists for Ebola.
There are suggestions. I mean, even in Stephanie's story, there are some sort of drugs that have been tried and it seems to have, like, stopped things. I mean, there are experimental. There's one experimental drug that the FDA stopped, and that's which sort of leads to sort of another sort of story, which is, again, the FDA, and there's been a lot of criticisms of the FDA for being rather slow in terms of sort of clearing drugs for development. So it may be a sort of a spur for the FDA to look again, you know, at some of their restrictions as well.
Well, it seems like a good opportunity for journalists to also really look at this angle, right?
Oh, I think so.
And, I mean, at a time when pharmaceutical profits are huge,
yep.
This is also a business angle, and you're a business reporter. So do you think we'll see more of this?
Well, I would hope so. The other thing I think it's also partly for political and government reporters to look at, too, again, what has also been happening in the past couple of years are budget cuts for the National Institute of Health. Basic research is being cut. Basic scientific research is being cut. So a lot of this research is now being sort of left to private companies who are going to basically, you know, going to look for a return on investment, understandably, you know, well, again, that might need to be rethought.
So kudos to your colleague Stephanie Lee for writing this piece, Why Ebola Remains a Disease Without a Drug. And Chris, before we get your story of the week, have you seen this angle in many pieces about Ebola?
No, I haven't. I specifically haven't seen that piece. I mean, obviously, there have been questions around why the experimental drug that's being used on the two Americans that have been brought back isn't available for use in West Africa.
Right.
And that's the nearest we've got to that.
And what did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I read a piece in the London Review of Books by Nathan Froll called Hamas's Chances, which is the most comprehensive explanation I've seen yet of the thread of events that led up to the present Gaza war. And he traces it back to the November 2012 ceasefire and the various interpretations of that ceasefire that then followed and how actually it was disintegrating in its own way, month by month, because of fundamental misunderstandings of why that ceasefire was holding. That Hamas believed that the ceasefire was holding because that they were not firing rockets, and they were not permitting other groups such as Islamic Jihad to fire rockets, and that that Israel would in time respond to elements of the ceasefire that required them to lift the blockade, and that Israel came to believe that the ceasefire was holding because of the deterrent effects of their previous attacks. And it talks about how the ceasefire began to unravel bit by bit, and how it was pushed along by events in Egypt, the coup in Egypt against Morsi's government, and eventually the killing of the three young Israeli men in the West Bank, all of which spun it out of control. And it's a very comprehensive and very balanced insight into the thinking from different perspectives of what was happening, the misunderstandings that were taking place. Mm.
Did you want to add something, Andrew?
I think it's a really good point, and I don't know if you saw the Wall Street Journal piece a couple of days ago, which went along sort of similar lines, but sort of talked about the Egyptian card that was played very, very differently under Sisi as it's been played under Morsi. Sisi does not like Hamas one bit, and so there was almost like this Egyptian-Israeli sort of axis that was opposed to Hamas, which made things very different. And the sort of ironic thing was that to the extent that it sort of got out of America's control, that basically Israel and Egypt were running the show for a while, much to the surprise of the Americans, which they didn't much care for. So they didn't really have much of a role in this. Maybe now that's changing.
So this piece is by Nathan Thrall, and it's called Hamas's Chances. We're actually going to do a show about Israel and Palestine on Tuesday. And Chris, since you brought this up, I wanted to ask you about a piece you wrote in The Guardian on July 31st called American Media's New Pro-Israel Bias, The Same Party Line at the Wrong Time. You write, evolving conversations on the ground demand probing questions on air, so why does TV news look like a Netanyahu ad? That was just a couple weeks ago. What are your thoughts on, I mean, today the ceasefire broke. What are your thoughts on media coverage since then?
Well, the point of the piece wasn't really about specifically about Gaza. What I was trying to say was, because I think there was some very good on-the-ground Gaza coverage, although some of the coverage that emanated from the studios in the United States was less good. But I was making a point about the broader coverage of Israel and Palestine and how some fundamental questions, which are rightly asked of the Palestinians, are rarely asked of the Israelis. For instance, the fact that actually there are a significant number of ministers in Netanyahu's cabinet who fundamentally don't really believe in the right of a Palestinian state to exist. And whilst Hamas is frequently asked about the right of Israel to exist, we rarely hear this discussed and what the implications are for any kind of peace process. So that was what I was getting into, is that the lack of broader understanding of what is happening in the region. And I mean, in terms of the coverage since, I think that, you know, a lot of good and difficult questions were asked of the Israelis about their conduct on the ground. But as I say, I don't think that the broader questions were asked and still aren't being asked.
Well, we are going to do a show about that on Tuesday, so be sure to tune in. That is Chris McGreal. He is a senior writer for The Guardian U.S., a former Washington correspondent, and was previously based in Johannesburg and Jerusalem. And before we talk about the U.S.-Africa Summit, Andrew or Mike, do you want to add anything about coverage of what's happening in Gaza? Anything strike you?
The only thing, you know, one of the things that struck me about that Wall Street Journal piece was just how entangled this web is and has become. And, you know, the victims of this web, which any number of actors are weaving, are the civilians in Gaza. Mm. They're the victims.
Mike, did you want to add anything?
No, I did see the story that was mentioned, and I just want to emphasize that was a really, I think, fair and balanced take on it. So I encourage your listeners to check it out.
All right. Well, thank you. So let's talk about this three-day summit in Washington, D.C., the first summit of its kind with a sitting U.S. leader. Chris, did 50 African leaders end up showing up?
Several of them dropped out because of the Ebola virus, three of them. There were five who weren't invited because they were either on an AU blacklist or a US blacklist, including Mugabe, Bashir. And then there were some, such as President Sisi of Egypt, who refused to come because he couldn't have a one-on-one meeting with Obama. Hmm. So we ended up with a couple of dozen, but there were prime ministers as well. There were foreign ministers where presidents didn't come. So 50 countries were represented in some form or another.
And I noticed that a lot of newspapers carried wire stories about Obama holding this conference because of his legacy. He wants to be remembered by doing something like this. What are your thoughts on this? Why did he decide to bring these heads of nations together? Why now?
Well, I think there are a number of factors at work. I think we can't ignore the fact that the surge of influence and presence of the Chinese in Africa is having a huge effect. The Europeans have, you know, picked up on this and started to make a much greater effort in Africa. If you look at the Chinese trade with Africa, 20 years ago it was $6 billion. Last year it was about $200 billion. And when you travel around Africa, you see two things that I, after 15 years of covering the continent, I didn't see in terms of Western influence, one of which is the amount of infrastructure that the Chinese are building. And if you go to a country like the Democratic Republic of Congo, over the years, the West poured $5 billion into the country, which then Zaire, run by Mobutu Sese Seko, and there was almost nothing to show for it. Go to Congo now, and there are roads everywhere, there are railway stations. In other parts of the continent, the Chinese are building ports. They're building bridges. They're throwing in lots of infrastructure. Now, a lot of this is for their own benefit, for the firms, the mines, and things that they're investing in. But they change the lives of people on the ground. And then the second thing you see is Chinese people. In countries such as Zambia, the people, the street traders who come to sell the cloth are actually Chinese. Now, that in some ways is bad news for the Zambians because it's driving their own textile industry out of business. But what it is doing is giving a Chinese presence on the ground, an intimacy to the relationship. And I think that the Americans belatedly realize just how fast that they are being pushed out and pushed aside in terms of trade on the continent. And then I think a second element was there were great expectations, as there were all over the world when Obama came to power, very unrealistic expectations as to what he was going to be able to do. But they were particularly strong in Africa for a couple of reasons, one of which was he has a Kenyan father, and also that he's African-American and it's first African-American in the White House. But also because George Bush had done a lot for Africa, particularly with his PEPFAR program, supplying antiretroviral drugs, which had saved about 1.5 million lives, transformed health systems, brought education to a lot of people, a lot of young children that weren't going to get it. And there was an expectation in Africa that Obama would build on that. And there was a perception in lots of countries that he just wasn't interested at the end of his first term. He visited last year and I think picked up on that. And there was a sense that he needed to be seen to be making an effort on Africa, and this summit is a result of that.
We have an email from Edwin who says, it was sad to see everyone talk about the summit as the United States and Africa getting equal partnership. This was aid disguised as trade and investment. It was really unfortunate that the press didn't point that out. The problem here, he writes, is that Africans who always talk about African solutions for African problems are still looking abroad to the U.S. and China for handouts and investments instead of working hard to use local talent to develop their economies. What are your thoughts on that, Chris?
Well, I think the first thing, you know, one of the problems here is talking about Africa. It's an entire continent.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, actually.
You know, and it has an incredible array of problems. So this was brought home, actually, in an interview that Charlie Rose moderated a panel. And there were five African presidents on it, and he decided he was going to ask about Ebola, and he turns to the president of Tanzania and asks him about Ebola. And the president of Tanzania points out that his country is on the other side of the continent from where the people are dying from Ebola, and then goes on to make a point, which I think is a very good point, about, you know, Ebola isn't an African disease, and people do not need to see one problem in part of Africa as a general Africa problem. And I think this comes, you know, down to all of these things, trade, human rights, security problems, all of which are, you know, issues in parts of Africa. And when it comes to development and trade, there are parts of Africa you can point to. I mean, South Africa, a very developed country, Nigeria, where there is a rapidly expanding economy. We are told, although numbers are always what they are, that six of the world's fastest growing economies are in six of the world's 10 fastest growing economies are in Africa. And you can you can see places where it's working very well, and you can see places where it's not working very well. Sometimes that comes down to natural resources. Sometimes that comes down to mismanagement. Sometimes it comes down to something as basic as just education, which is a huge issue in some countries. You know, it's very hard for people to uplift themselves without a proper education. So it's hard to be general about what the issue, the development issues are for an entire continent.
Well, exactly. And I wanted to ask you this, Andrew. I mean, how do you cover a conference like this where you've got 50 countries represented over the course of 3 days? And Africa is the second largest and second most populous continent on Earth with about 1 billion people. I mean, you could write about one country over the course of 3 days. So what are your thoughts on that? And how do you think the U.S. covers Africa? You'll have like a CNN special, Africa, on Friday. Right.
The first thing that crops my mind is perhaps we could all try a little harder. There's a reasonable amount of coverage in the American press of Africa in Africa. I mean, there could certainly be more. But one of the things that struck me, and I'm sort of like partly guilty, I'm very guilty, is that I've not seen a lot of coverage about this summit. I mean, a lot of, you know, African leaders are here. It's a summit. It's in Washington. You would think that more attention would have been paid, but maybe I haven't been reading the right press or going online properly, but I haven't seen very much of it. So that surprised me a little bit. I think more could have been done. I think there are always sort of angles and themes and features. You know, you've got a hook in journalistic parlance. You've got a hook here. You've got a hook to tell stories, perhaps, that need to be told, and probably some reporters and writers have always wanted to tell, but somehow it hasn't happened, you know. And so I think that's just, I just think that's a falling off. Just to go back to one point that the emailer sent in, my understanding is that there is actually a lot of talent in Africa. And there's a fair amount of sort of money that's sort of been going into entrepreneurship in Africa, especially in things like the mobile media space. So here is a continent that is already starting to jump a technological generation. You know, forget landlines altogether. We'll just go straight to mobile, and that's been happening in Africa for some time and other parts of the world, which is an enormous boost to people like farmers, you know, who can like communicate much more quickly than they have done before. And I think that's really important that areas of the world that can jump a tech that can leave an entire generation of technology behind because they never really had it, I think is very important. I think Africa is potentially an example of that.
What angles would you be interested in reading about? I mean, if you were to send a reporter to D.C. to cover this, how would you go about doing it?
I'm not necessarily that D.C. would necessarily be the place to do it because it's going to be very, very formal. I think was there one complaint I think it was Chris just said that CC was angry.
Obama didn't meet with anyone personally.
He wouldn't meet with anybody,
right.
And there was no press conferences out of it. So,
right.
I mean, I think that just doing it from Washington would be very, very restrictive. You could perhaps look a little more deeply into what the United States has been doing in the past few years and how come Obama, you know, hasn't done much except visit, you know, Africa once. I mean, you could sort of do that, but where you want to be and the stories I think you want to see are stories from the places that the leaders are coming from.
That is Andrew Ross. He writes the Bottom Line business column for the San Francisco Chronicle. We're also joined by Mike Konzall, fellow at the Roosevelt Institute and a contributor to The Nation. He just launched a monthly economics column for The Nation called The Score. His latest piece is about the real solution to wealth inequality, and we'll talk about that later in the hour. And we're joined by Chris McGreal. He's a senior writer for The Guardian U.S. He's been covering the Africa Summit. Chris is a former Washington correspondent and was previously based in Johannesburg and Jerusalem. And after the break, we'll continue talking about the Africa Summit. What did we learn? What should we have learned? And then later on, we'll talk about tax cuts and corporations. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on local public radio, KALW. There are many ways you can take part in today's conversation on the phone by sending an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or by going to yourcallradio.org website. If you'd like to participate in today's show by phone, call toll-free 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. 798-TALK. Coming up at 11, it's news from a world perspective and world have your say, reactions to the renewed bombardment of Gaza, as well as the U.S. airstrikes in Iraq, coming ahead on World Have Your Say at 11. Stay with us here on Local Public Radio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we're going to have a conversation about a great documentary called Alive Inside. It explores music's ability to combat memory loss through the experience of individuals who've been rejuvenated by listening. So how does music affect our brains and people who are aging or mostly unresponsive? And what role does music play in your life? Alive Inside actually is in theaters starting today. So if you can see it today or over the weekend, that would be great. And then be sure to tune in Monday. We'll talk about the potential healing power of music. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our media roundtable, the day we speak with reporters about coverage of the week's news. And we're going to spend a few more minutes on the Africa Summit. If you have any questions, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. And then we'll switch gears and talk about corporations that are moving or say they're going to move overseas to avoid taxes. Walgreens just said that it would not relocate after a major public pressure campaign. We're joined by Chris McGreal, senior writer for The Guardian U.S. Andrew Ross writes the Bottom Line business column for The Chronicle. And Mike Konzol is a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute and a contributor to The Nation magazine. And Edwin, thank you for the email. We have another email from Cornelius who says, thanks for talking about the U.S.-Africa Summit. There was an alternative gathering in D.C. of civil society activists that took place at the same time as the official summit, and there was a story in the Washington Post. And thanks for the link, Cornelius. Also, Chris, you tweeted there was a sign from the Democratic Union of Gambian activists. It said U.S. Africa Summit equals Obama Dictator Summit. And Human Rights Watch pointed out that at least a dozen of the 50 heads of state who attended lead repressive governments that have imprisoned journalists, human rights defenders, and anti-corruption campaigners. But you point out that security and trade got the most attention, not human rights issues.
Well, trade was definitely the emphasis and the most public emphasis, for sure. But security and human rights issues, in some cases, are bound up. I mean, Africa has changed a lot from when I first reported on the continent 25 years ago, when that was the era of the big men, and you had the continent divided according to Cold War allegiances. There's been a great deal more democratization and accountability since then. You have a younger generation in many countries which are much better informed, partly because of what was just mentioned about technology, much more willing to press their governments for accountability, and largely the end of the one-party state. But there are definitely human rights issues, and some of them are tied up with the emerging conflicts around Islamist groups. I mean, Boko Haram in northern Nigeria is a very good example, and the actions of the Kenyan military against Al-Shabaab from Somalia. And this is an area that the Americans were treading carefully on, because essentially they want to back these governments against Islamist groups, but they can't be too close to them. Can't give too close military support because, for instance, the Nigerian military in fighting Boko Haram has been responsible for massacres of civilians, destruction of property. And the concern, a very practical concern on the U.S.'s part, is that if they are identified with the Nigerian military's abuses, that will turn what remains largely a Nigerian issue, potentially globalize it, turn Boko Haram's attention towards the Americans joining up with groups in neighboring countries such as Mali. And the same really with Kenya. So the security issue is a difficult one. There are also trade and human rights issues. I mean, if you look at a country such as Equatorial Guinea, it's had the same leader since 1979. He has a lot of blood on his hands. There was a point where the United States essentially suspended diplomatic relations with him, and then in the 1990s, oil was discovered. American oil companies got in there, and they, relations are now much more intimate, as you might imagine. And whilst there's certain criticism of the human rights situation in Equatorial Guinea, not much is done about it in practice. And there are questions, around allies such as U.S. allies such as Uganda and Rwanda, increasingly authoritarian regimes. Same person in power for a couple of decades or more, and a shrinking democratic space. All of this was theoretically part of the agenda, but not specifically on it as a subject. It was apparently discussed behind closed doors. The Americans say they put pressure on, for instance, on Joseph Kabila, the president of Congo, to abide by the constitution and step down in 2016 after two terms. But it's not clear how much that was pushed to the fore of the discussions.
And Mike, before we let Chris go, did you have a comment or a question for him?
Yeah, I'm curious how he sees the situation evolving in the next few years. What is the likelihood that things will probably move forward, or what do you see as potentially things people should watch for, especially reporters or policy people?
On the whole, to generalize about a continent, I just said you can't generalize about it.
Right.
But if we take sub-Saharan Africa away from the immediate conflict zones around Somalia and northern Nigeria and Cameroon, I think on the whole there's a move in the right direction, in that there is increasing accountability. There is a very young population. Half the population sub-Saharan Africa is under the age of 30. They are more willing to stand up to authority. They have more expectations than perhaps their parents did, because they have access to information, how other people live. They see changes in neighboring countries that were once very similar to themselves and now are much more democratic. Trade is opening things up. But I think if we were to look at a couple of things, one is what the influence of the Chinese will be. The Chinese are not tying assistance or trade to human rights or democratization. And that clearly is an out for some countries, such as Angola, because they simply deal directly with the Chinese as much as they can and don't have to worry about those pressures. But nonetheless, there's still internal pressures from the population, and China can only deliver so much, particularly when it comes to a lot of technology. And I think the other thing I would watch very closely is what happens in South Africa, because a lot of governments, a lot of countries look to South Africa. It has the most stable democracy, even though it's been the ANC in power for the past 20 years. It's a country of the rule of law. It had an election that was a large turnout, a strong vote against the ANC. Although it won, but it was a complicated situation. But on the left of the ANC, there was a new party, the Economic Freedom Fighters. They did very well, and that is the ANC's Achilles heel in South Africa. And I would watch that closely, how the ANC reacts to that, whether the democratic space there opens and there's a dispersal of power. And that will have a big impact on the future of Southern Africa in particular.
Well, Chris, there's a lot of interest in this, so we definitely have to do a show. We need an entire hour to really talk about this. But thank you so much for joining us.
A pleasure.
Thank you. That is Chris McGreal. He's a senior writer for The Guardian US, former Washington correspondent, and was previously based in Johannesburg and Jerusalem. And you can find his reporting at yourcallradio.org. And sticking with us for the rest of the hour is Andrew Ross. He writes the Bottom Line business column for the San Francisco Chronicle. And Mike Konzol is a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute and a contributor to The Nation. Mike just launched a monthly economics column for The Nation called The Score. We'll talk about his piece about wealth inequality in just a couple minutes. But first, I wanted to get you both to comment on an interview that President Obama gave to The Economist last weekend. It's making a lot of headlines. He talked about his friendly relationship with big business, but also there's this perception that's enforced by the media that he has a kind of hostile relationship with business, or he's got some anti-business policies. But we'll talk about that. Let's hear first this clip from The Economist interview with President Obama.
if you look at what our policies have been, they have generally been friendly towards business, while at the same time recognizing there's certain core interests, fiscal interests, environmental interests, interests in maintaining stability of the financial system, where, yes, we're placing constraints on them. It probably cuts into the certain profit centers in their businesses. I understand why they would be frustrated by it, but the flip side of it is that they'd be even more unhappy if the global financial system unravels. Nobody has more of a stake in it than them. Last point I'll make on this. If you look at what's happened over the last 4 or 5 years, the folks who don't have a right to complain are the folks at the top. Where we have made less progress than I would like, and is my obsession since I came into office and will continue to be my obsession until I leave office and afterwards, is the broader trend of an increasingly bifurcated economy where those at the top are getting a larger and larger share of GDP, increased productivity, corporate profits, and middle class and working class families are stuck.
That is a clip from an interview President Obama gave to The Economist last weekend, and it's getting a lot of attention. Andrew, why is this getting so much attention?
Well, first of all, Obama is sort of essentially absolutely right. The last 4 to 7, 8 years have worked extremely well for big business and for corporations. He's absolutely right. The constraints that he talks about, they're kind of like a little kind of annoying, but they can sort of be got around. And at least so far, they haven't stopped corporations, big business, making more profits than ever and driving coaches and horses through various tax loopholes, which, again, the president said he wanted to address, but has not. Now, there's a whole other story about who's to blame here, which, we can perhaps get into. I think that he gets a lot of blame from big business, which is, of course, absurd. And I think it's only from certain segments of big business, but that's what they do. They complain, especially about Democrats. That's sort of partly the way that it is. I remember those once when he talked about reforming carried interest. That's how hedge fund managers and private equity managers have to pay a tax rate on their money of only 15% as opposed to standard income tax rate.
Right.
And Steve Schwarzman, the head of Blackstone, came out with this famous reaction that he likened it to the Nazis invading Poland. So that's the kind of rhetoric that has somehow come forth from the business community. Mm. He's instantly, of course, apologized. But, so that thing about blaming, it's all Obama's fault, it's sort of ridiculous.
It's so silly. Mike, how should the media deal with this when corporations' CEOs come out and say these things at a time when corporations hit another record high last year, rising to $1.6 trillion with a T? 19 executives raked in more than $100 million in income last year. The median CEO pay for Standard & Poor's 500 companies rose 13% to $10.5 million. This is just average now, $10 million salaries. So how should the media respond when corporate executives claim that there's this rocky relationship going on?
Well, it shows that corporate executives are not looking for a middle ground, or they're not looking for a best way forward in which, they are much more profitable, but they have a much, greater tax burden, for instance, or a greater regulatory burden. It is remarkable to look at the financial crisis, both the buildup to it, the bad debts that were made in order to, rip off investors, the communities that are suffering huge foreclosures, the crisis of Lehman Brothers, and not think that you need a substantial response. What President Obama had put forward in what ultimately became Dodd-Frank, the Financial Regulatory Reform Act, is a lot of middle of the road. It shows how tilted the road is if, the CEOs and business organizations are attacking it so viciously. you know, at the beginning of the process, something, the CFPB, Elizabeth Warren's brainchild, Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, basically just say, take all the consumer regulators and put them in one house and give them the mission to, you know, keep an eye on whether or not consumers are getting ripped off. You know, the Chamber of Commerce launched a huge $2 million campaign, or multi-million dollar campaign against it. I mean, it is shocking how much they both don't under, like, there's no point at which they're going to say, okay, you know what, this new regulation, these new taxes are responsible and reasonable given the shape of the economy. They're always going to want a little bit more, and they're always going to want a little less accountability and a little bit more, they're going to want to have more of a stake in what's going on here. And, you know, I think President Obama, kind of like in the same way, you know, Obama's in some ways sort of a tragic figure here, because kind of like his relationship with the Republicans, I think he thought he was going to be able to kind of create a new dawn and, you know, kind of end a lot of the partisan fighting in Congress with the Republicans, you know, kind of recreate a relationship with the business community. And both of them have essentially said, no, we're not going to meet you halfway on any of this stuff. And he does, you know, you can see he struggles to try to, like, figure out what he can do this. And, you know, it's interesting, he's taking up the rhetoric of people like John Edwards, rhetoric that was not in the center even, you know, 8 years ago, about the idea that the economy is really becoming two Americas. And, you know, the evidence is becoming much more convincing, and the counter evidence is not. And you can watch him try to struggle to do this. And I think it's really going to define, I think it's super relevant, obviously, because it's our working lives and it impacts all of us, but it will definitely impact the next election, because whoever the contender is, Hillary Clinton or other people, will have to decide if President Obama went too far or not far enough with the business community, because right now it doesn't feel like a good center.
I think it ought to be said that the Republicans also weren't willing to meet the president halfway, and they made that very, very clear from the first day that he was actually elected, that basically the idea was to, you know, make sure he doesn't have a second term. And so when you have a 60-vote, you know, mandate to get stuff through the Senate, and you have a House controlled by Republicans, who are not going to do any favors for Obama come what may, there's an awful lot of things that Obama has tried to do and has suggested that have gone absolutely nowhere. So, I mean, I think that sort of needs to be said. The other thing that I'd like to just sort of say is the second part of what Obama said that you played a clip of, where he said he's sort of, you know, obsessed with inequality and doing something about it. And I think he also said at one point that he was going to devote the rest of his term, you know, to, like, really thinking about inequality, I'm sure was very well meant. I think he absolutely believes it. What a president can do about it is a whole other matter. I mean, I think we need to also sort of dispense with the illusion that a president of the United States is almighty. It is very, very clear from what has happened in this administration that that simply is not the case. And the factors behind growing inequality are way beyond, you know, what I think a single politician or president can really do. This has been going on for some time. It's not just true in the United States, although it's, like, really, really bad here, you know, but there are any number of factors. Thomas Piketty's book just very, very clearly lays a lot of this out very, very factually about how, as finance has become more global, that is another way that things have sort of gone a little bit beyond any single individual's control. And at the same time, you have even the CEO of Goldman Sachs, the International Monetary Fund, Standard & Poor's, saying, yes, this inequality thing, it's a real problem. We got to do something about it. It's dangerous socially. It's dangerous economically. Well, okay. Now what?
Well, now what, Mike? What are your thoughts on Andrew's comments? And talk a little bit about the piece she wrote about the real solution to wealth inequality. What could be done given the realities we're facing in Washington?
Sure. So, you know, there's two issues here. There's one is income inequality. So what does your paycheck look like? What, you know, how much do you negotiate for your salary? Which is particularly in the United States and England a huge phenomenon. Like, it's but, you know, there's a lot of inequality. The 1% CEOs, finance, hedge fund managers make a lot of money. People in the middle, you know, have been kind of bouncing around at the same point, even though our economy is becoming much richer. And people at the bottom end are struggling to get by or falling behind. And, you know, income is fundamentally about living standards. And, you know, there's ways to deal with that. One is you can obviously give people money, you know, and you see proposals. President Obama proposed a large increase in the earned income tax credit, which is basically saying if you're a working poor person, the government will kind of top off your salary. And, you know, Paul Ryan in his recent poverty budget essentially doubled, adopted that a very similar plan as well. There's minimum wage legislation, which we know, among other things, will collapse inequality in the bottom half. I mean, it sets a floor on wages in such a way that kind of, you know, reduces poverty and increases wage. There's a lot of debate about what it does to jobs, but it certainly does decrease inequality at the low end. And, you know, President Obama raised taxes. He brought them back to the Clinton era. He imposed some new taxes to help pay for Medicare. And, you know, for you know, everyday working people in the middle of the income distribution, wages obviously are a problem, but so is the increasing cost of things like healthcare and education. And if Obamacare ultimately works, if it's with us 10 years from now, if it is controlled some of the, if it has moderated the cost of healthcare, and that's going to do a lot. It might not necessarily put more actual dollars in people's pockets, but it'll make those dollars go further. Now, wealth inequality is a whole other issue, and there, I think. And this is obviously what Thomas Piketty's book is all about, and it's about the other big piece, I think, of the kind of intellectual blockbuster on the left this past year was Ta-Nehisi Coates's The Case for Reparations, where it was really about the way wealth has been strip mined out of black communities over the ever since Reconstruction, but even, you know, obviously during the housing bubble and during the 20th century. And there, that becomes a little bit of a complicated issue about how you fight wealth inequality. Because, you know, if you think back to George W. Bush's ownership society, there's always been this Republican thing about helping people build wealth by making everyone a homeowner or privatizing Social Security so you have your own individual savings account and, you know, individualizing a small amount of wealth building. And I think that's often the wrong way to go because a lot of it's very difficult for people to manage. A lot of it, you know, as we saw in the housing bubble, becomes a total mess when people who can't afford mortgages get them, especially get predatory ones. And I think another solution is to kind of decommodify or socialize some of these things, like, for instance, Social Security. You know, that's something that provides genuine support in old age, though it's not wealth in the way Piketty measures it. It's not something you can borrow against or take out with fees. It is a genuine form of social wealth that does provide deep security and essentially has radically reduced, if not eliminated, poverty in old age. That's different than trying to, you know, help everyone invest more in their own 401k. And I think that different way of viewing things is really important because I think the wealth inequality issue, as Andrew Ross said, the stuff's not going away.
Right.
You know, these things are going to stay with us.
Well, and also you just brought up an idea. I think we should do a show about this. Like, what could he actually do, right? Because there are so many solutions on the table, but what could be done at this point? I want to ask, we have just a few minutes left, but I wanted to also talk about Walgreens, because the president has been pushing to slow down or reverse the relocation of corporations to other countries for tax purposes. This is called inversion. We talked a bit about it last week. And Andrew, in your latest piece, you wrote, for Walgreens, angry calls and letters from lawmakers, threatening statements from the White House, newspaper editorials galore, plus petitions signed by 200,000 Americans have basically resulted in Walgreens saying, oh, well, we'll buy Boots, but we're not going to relocate to the UK to get tax breaks. So how significant is this?
Good question. I think for Walgreens, the pain just sort of outweighed the gain going forward. I think a lot of that had to do with it. And, you know, maybe just they weren't going to maybe get enough tax reduction. What this means going forward is going to be very interesting to see. I mean, does it actually put a little bit of a chill on this, what one referred to as almost like a feeding frenzy of tax inversions with people lining up left and right, you know, to change their citizenship and reduce the U.S. corp, thereby reducing their taxes. And I just think it remains to be seen. And I think I said in one of the pieces I wrote that there's a couple of particular cases that need to be looked at fairly closely. One is, you know, is AbbVie taking over Shire, you know, where they want to do a tax inversion. The other one is Medtronic and Covidien, also, which is also sort of on track, and it's going to be very interesting to see what happens, whether they sort of pull back, try and find a way out, whether the heat is getting too much, whether the president does in fact move forward with a very risky executive action thing. In other words, we're going to bypass Congress like I've been doing in other places, and I'm just going to say, no, you can't do this and that. How that's going to fly, I'm not sure whether Congress will actually ever get together, you know, and do and say they also want to do something about this specifically, but then you've got other, you've got Republicans saying yes, but only in the context of, quote, comprehensive tax reform. So it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. Hedge funds who bet a lot on these inversions on Walgreens lost a lot of money, and so it's going to be up to them to see how hard they're going to push other companies to go the same thing. Or they may just say, you know what, maybe we just ought to cool it for a while because it's just getting too hot.
It also proves that the public really does take action on these issues when
They got a rouse on this one. Yeah. It's America's pharmacy, for God's sake.
So many stores across the country,
I mean,
right?
Come on. You know?
Yeah. So do you think it was the public pressure campaign that did this?
I think it had a lot to do with it. I think it all had something to do with it. And I think one thing built on the other. I think the complaints that came from here, some of the press reporting that was done, you know, I think sort of helped raise the level of this issue. Then Congress, Democratic senators got involved. They started pushing forward. Organizations like Credo started pushing petitions and got this overwhelming response. The Treasury, and then, of course, that hit. The White House started paying attention. Jacob Lew, the Treasury Secretary, came and said, we really got to do something about this. The IRS said, we're looking into it. And President Obama then, as you said, came out and said, this is unpatriotic. You know, and I just, yeah, you know, I'm just sort of thinking about maybe just like signing my pen and stopping it.
Well, so this started in the late 90s when Fruit of the Loom reincorporated.
Oh, it started a long time ago, yeah.
Yeah, and so there's Chiquita Banana. Do you know other companies?
They're on. There's a couple of others whose names I can't quite recall now.
Well, we're doing a show on Thursday about corporate pressure campaigns, so we'll bring those up.
Okay.
Because it's something people need to know. Thank you so much. Andrew Ross writes the Bottom Line business column for the San Francisco Chronicle, and Mike Konzol is a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute and a contributor to The Nation. Andrew and Mike, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. What is the potential healing power of music? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with filmmaker Michael Rosato Bennett about his new documentary, Alive Inside. The film explores music's ability to combat memory loss through the experience of individuals who've been rejuvenated by listening to iPods. How does music affect our brains and people who are aging or mostly unresponsive? And what role does music play in your life? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. Becca Hoekstra produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David LaTulipe is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.